Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. I'm Jan McIntosh Brown.
And I'm Helen McLean.
And in this episode, I'm delighted to say we're going to talk about something that I am not experienced at all, and it is prolonged disorders of consciousness, or PDOC. And I'm so glad that Helen's here to talk about this, as she has more experience and training for sure than me.
Yeah, it is all relative. I would still say I am by far an expert in this. I've seen a few patients over the years who fit the PDOC criteria. So I'm sure if you're listening to this and have lots more experience and maybe want to add to any of the things that I say or feel I'm not quite explaining things as well as perhaps they could be, then by all means get in touch, and if you would like to come on as a guest, then that would be amazing.
Yes, we're always keen to hear from people and have them share their stories and experiences. A couple of things before we get Helen to share some information with us is that the first thing is that this is the second time that we've recorded this introduction. Unfortunately, our first recording was unsuccessful, so we are now in different locations doing this. So you'll find that the quality of this first part of the podcast is different from later on in the podcast, where Helen and I were more successful recording together. So we do apologise for that. Also, I'd like to put my hand up to say, because I knew very little about PDOC, and I knew that I was going to be chatting to Helen about this, I wanted to find out some interesting and intelligent things to ask. So we'd been at the third CCD symposium earlier in the year, and Emma Power had talked to us all about the use of Chat GPT. So I thought, hey, great opportunity to use this AI and get some intelligent questions to ask Helen. You can tell me if you think they're intelligent or not later on. But so, yes, we used typed into Chat GPT questions that I should ask a speech therapist about PDOC. And so on the basis of this, that's what I've sent to Helen as questions that I will be asking her. So thanks, Chat GPT. Thanks, Emma Power. And thanks, Helen.
So, yeah, and I will say the questions that it came up with were really quite impressive. So it just shows the power of AI, something to be amazed by and slightly in awe of. And we certainly don't cover all the questions that Chat GPT came up with in this conversation. But yeah, definitely an interesting tool.
Yeah. So Chat GPT came up with the questions, but the content is based on Helen's experience and training. So Helen, let's get this ball rolling. So where do we start? What is PDOC? Can you describe it to us?
Yeah, sure. So I think that's the best place to start. So PDOC stands for Prolonged Disorders of Consciousness. So this is something that can occur after a very severe brain injury. So we are talking about a relatively small percentage of people who have an acquired brain injury, and it is something that an injury that is so severe that it has led to this person being in a reduced state of awareness of their surroundings. So sometimes you might see it called reduced awareness state as well. So a way that we might describe it is that it's kind of a continuum of consciousness. So someone might be on kind of a spectrum almost of how aware they are of their surroundings. So at the most severe end of this continuum, we might see someone who is in a coma. So that is the state where they have absolutely no awareness of their surroundings and no state of alertness, and are unable to interact with their surroundings. And then we kind of move up through something called vegetative states into a minimally conscious state. And then we might describe the person starting to emerge, or they have emerged to a point where they are aware of their surroundings and are able to interact with them to a greater or lesser extent. And when I say that, I mean that they might be alert and able to communicate with people around them or walk around the environment that they're in, but they might still have very significant cognitive difficulties just due to the severe nature of the brain injury that has occurred to lead them to be into this situation in the first place. So we're going to focus today on vegetative state and minimally conscious states. It is worth mentioning that occasionally we might be looking at something called locked-in syndrome as well, which is a whole other area of severe brain injury. And we won't go into that today, but it's just to mention it, that it is something to be aware of. It's where someone has no ability to kind of move. Their motor skills have been severely affected, so they can't move their arms, legs, maybe move their head, etc. But their thinking skills, their cognition's preserved. So it's just to kind of mention as an aside that there is that, and I didn't want anyone to be listening to this who's aware of locked-in syndrome to think we're completely disregarding it. We are aware that this is an aspect of severe brain injury, but it's not the scope of what we're talking about today. So hopefully that makes sense. And I thought, Jan, would it help for me to talk a little bit about what we mean by vegetative state and minimally conscious state?
Yeah, definitely, Helen. And you know, when maybe you can come to this a bit later, but you know, when you were talking about that emerging consciousness, I guess I have worked with a couple of people where I'm kind of thinking, well, maybe they actually were in the prolonged disorders of consciousness, or you know, how I would actually differentiate between someone that maybe has a severe or significant, profound cognitive disability due to the brain injury that's, you know, awake most of the day. You know, I'm not quite sure if that's something that we will cover later.
Yeah, we might get into to that. I will say that it can be really difficult to
Okay.
see a point where, okay, what are we talking about? Are
One's
we talking
a person's in this stage and
you?
then in that stage yet. I guess
Yeah,
it might be
yeah.
quite transitional.
And yeah, and I think for what kind of the people who know more about this stuff than I do, and are doing ongoing research, I think there's more kind of fine details coming through about how well we decide when they're, how well we differentiate between these different stages, particularly as we're getting to a point of emerging from a disorder of consciousness. So yeah, we can talk hopefully a little bit more about that. I will kind of just go into a bit about vegetative state, just because that's, if we're thinking of this continuum of consciousness, that's kind of the first stage after coma. So at this point, someone in a vegetative state might be able to open their eyes and maybe show some other reflex movements. So they might be grinding their teeth. They might be. They might be blinking sometimes. But these are movements that are not predictable or appear to be in response to what's happening around them. They are just kind of happening at different times. They're not happening at points where we are, for example, shining a light into someone's eyes and your eye would automatically blink. the person in a vegetative state might not show a response to that light being shone in the eyes, but they might still blink at some points, if that makes sense. Just the other thing to say about vegetative state around kind of eye function is people's eyes might water, and so it might appear that they have tears in their eyes, that they're crying. But when we look at the overall picture, we're seeing that that is just that that's part of the kind of reflexive response of the body. Someone in a vegetative state as well might have periods where they appear to be awake and times where they appear to be asleep. And that ties in, I think, a little bit, Jan, with what you were saying about of that timing of how long someone might be doing something for. So there is a kind of sleep-wake cycle, but it can sometimes be very difficult to figure out exactly the time scales of those, because someone is they might be awake but not necessarily responding to what's around them. So their eyes might be closed, but they're not actually asleep, if that makes sense, hopefully.
Oh yeah, I can see how difficult that would be, you know, to sort of map somebody's length of time awake, because we're not always awake. Should I say, we're not always asleep when our eyes are closed, you know? So yeah, I can see how tricky that would be. I guess I'm a bit of a concrete person. I like things that I can count, you know. So
We will get into kind of the assessment process of this, but I guess it is just worth kind of mentioning that none of this is just a one-off assessment to see to decide if someone is in a vegetative state or minimally conscious state. There's lots of assessments by lots of professionals. This doesn't just come down to speech and language therapists working on their own to decide this. So, there's lots of factors at play here. The next stage up on this kind of continuum of consciousness is minimally conscious state, which can be split into two levels even within that. And that's been, I think, a more recent addition over in kind of more recent years. So we might have something called minimally conscious state plus and minimally conscious state minus, so a higher level and a lower level. In general, minimally conscious state individuals are still showing that they are opening and closing their eyes. They have a sleep-wake cycle, just like someone in a vegetative state, but they're starting to show some behaviours that are not just reflexes. So they are perhaps particularly in a minimally conscious state plus level, showing some responses to commands. So, for example, move your hand, open your eyes, move your head, move your toes. These sorts of commands that we might ask someone to do to see can they follow an instruction. Maybe look at something, look at an object that you might have. And the minimally conscious state lower level, there might be some localization to stimuli in the environment. So I might move around someone's room and be out with their line of sight, but if I say their name or make some noise, do they try and turn their head to kind of give you an indication of I've heard something, I've heard my name be called, or heard the sound of someone rattling something or clapping their hands, and we're trying to see what that noise was. Or even just following you as you're walking around the room. So we're starting to see some awareness of what's going on around us and attempting to follow instructions at that higher level, and at the lower level, potentially just showing an awareness of there's things going on around me, and I want to see what that is. So yeah, there's a few other things as well to say about minimally conscious state with regards to us, particularly as speech and language therapists.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.
Yes, so the other thing I want to mention about minimally conscious state as well is that people at this stage might be able to use like an object that's quite commonly found. So, for example, give them a hairbrush and they appropriately use that to brush their hair, or give them a phone and they start to maybe type a message on it or hold it up to their ear. So I think that's important for us as speech therapists to kind of just note that, because that's something we might quite often do in assessment. We ask a person, or, you know, what is this, or show me how to use it, and that applies for people in PDOC as well.
Yeah, and so that brings to mind again, Helen, that sort of question that I had earlier about when I'm looking at someone who might be minimally conscious and they're maybe responding to some commands and maybe using an object here and there. And then I'm thinking about someone else that I worked with who was awake for large amounts of the day, but also had those behaviours, or was limited to those behaviours of, you know, having some reflexes and following a command here and there. But they would not be PDOC. So it kind of circles back to that question, is there criteria about the amount of time someone is awake or alert, responsive, in terms of the definitions?
Yeah, I think in terms of that specificity, maybe someone could correct me on this, I don't know if there's guidance around, or a person is in minimally conscious state because they sleep for this amount of time. I guess there's a lot to be said around when is that person no longer minimally conscious, but now they're potentially what we call emerged, but have significant cognitive difficulties, which would tap into what you were saying about your individual, because I think you were saying earlier that this individual could come to a group, for example, but then not necessarily participate in the way that other people could, but maybe sometimes they could, sometimes they couldn't. And I think there's a lot to be kind of discussed there around probably not minimally conscious, because they're maybe up and independently getting to where they need to be, but their cognition is so severely impacted that that's what is making it difficult. So it is to say, you know, we might talk about people that have emerged from being in a disorder of consciousness, but that is not to say that they're not left with significant difficulties that are requiring ongoing rehabilitation, because we are talking about a population of people who have had very severe brain injuries of some kind to have even been in that situation in the first place, to have been in some sort of altered state of consciousness for some period of time. It's just that some people come through that period much more quickly than others, you know. But when we're talking about prolonged disorders of consciousness, we are talking about people who are in that kind of reduced awareness state for a significant period of time. So I think that was something that we were going to mention, was just around kind of what some of the data is showing. So just to mention that what is kind of, I think, from data collected nationally, a little over 50% of patients who are in a vegetative state 1 month after traumatic injury will regain some degree of awareness. So we're talking about half of people, roughly, in a vegetative state takes a month, you know, and that's a long time if you were that person and that person's family. There is a difference between traumatic and non-traumatic. So we might be thinking about someone whose brain's been starved of oxygen and had what we call an anoxic injury, for example, after a cardiac arrest. If that person is still in a vegetative state after a month, what the data shows is that fewer than 20% of those cases will recover. So it's quite a dramatic difference between someone who's had a traumatic versus a non-traumatic injury. Then if we're thinking about longer term,
what we kind of see is that beyond 1 year for traumatic injuries and 3 months for non-traumatic injuries, the chances of regaining consciousness, emerging from vegetative or minimally conscious state, is now extremely low. So we're unlikely to see much change in someone's situation after that 1 year for a traumatic injury or 3 months for a non-traumatic injury.
And of course there's outliers,
yep,
as we've all heard of.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the ones that obviously family members will say, but I've read about this person, and it's extremely difficult to navigate through that because you don't want to take away family's hopes. But the unfortunate reality is that most people will
persist.
Yeah, and we'll be in that kind of bell curve of people that we tend to see, you know, that are remaining within, you know, if they are in that vegetative state, for example, 1 year post their traumatic injury, the likelihood of them recovering beyond that is extremely poor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a challenging area to work in. You know, this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And talking about that then, because I think one of the big challenges is assessment. So thinking about the speech and language therapy role and assessment, mm-hmm, and even, you know, treatment. I mean,
yeah.
Can you comment?
So, yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is just obviously as a speech and language therapist, we are the people that know about communication and know about swallowing. But we absolutely have to work alongside other people within a multidisciplinary team to try and have the best outcome for that individual. So we can't just work in our little silos. The speech therapist will absolutely be crossing over with the physiotherapist, with the occupational therapist, the dietitian, with any rehab consultants, etc. But we are the ones that can be figuring out, is there an element of aphasia that's having an impact on that person's ability to participate in responding to questions that are being asked of them? Is there a severe dysarthria that means that they can't convey what they want to say? Yeah. Is there an apraxia of speech? All of these sorts of things, we are the ones that have got the ability to assess for that. And we are skilled in doing that with other populations and other caseloads that we see. So if you're not seeing PDOC patients very often, you might not feel as confident, but you still have those skills and you just take that same skill set and apply it in that way to the case that you have in front of you. Obviously, you know, if you can tap into other colleagues who do have more experience, then great. But if you're working somewhere that you are the person, don't feel, I can't do this. You still have those skills.
There's a great tool that I got a chance to look at last year called a pragmatic rating tool. I can't remember the actual name of it. I don't know if it's been released yet, but it was just looking at, it was based on a tool that was developed for people with, you know, learning disabilities, and looking at how they were communicating in different situations. So it's been adapted for use of working with people with brain injuries, and it's just looking at all those semantic pragmatic functions that we all use, requesting, denying, all those different ways, and trying to map out from people that are with that person daily how they believe that person is communicating those messages. And I think that sounds very sort of familiar to something in with PDOC. It's about, you know, I think you mentioned before, Helen, about, you know, speech and language therapists are great at sort of pooling that information together and looking at it and trying to find patterns within the behaviours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. So I think even if you feel, I am not skilled, I'm not experienced in this area, you still absolutely have that core clinical skill
understanding
set.
Of yeah. communication and the functions of it.
Yeah, and I think as well the other thing to mention here is that as well as the Royal College of Physician guidelines that are available online, There are specific guidelines for speech and language therapists working with adults in a disorder of consciousness that were developed, I think just within the last couple of years, developed by UK speech and language therapists, including colleagues from Royal Hospital for Neurodisability and a few other NHS trusts across England, and in collaboration with RCSLT. So that's available online and is an excellent resource for looking at specific areas around assessing communication, using alternative and augmentative communication aids, tracheostomy management, saliva management, hypersensitivity, all of these things.
Excuse the dog drinking in the background.
I know. Oh, yeah, I was trying to decide if I would comment on that or not, but yes, the one time I forget to shut the kitchen door. So yeah, and that is worth maybe kind of mentioning around the kind of the swallowing aspect.
Yes,
our role thanks, as well. Rue. Yes, Rhubarb, come to join us. So yeah, I think maybe sometimes we might think, oh, a person in a prolonged disorder of consciousness couldn't possibly have a safe, she says in inverted commas, safe swallow. But I think what we're seeing is more that actually it is beneficial to assess that, because some patients can manage some oral intake, that it is possible to carry out a video fluoroscopy assessment of someone's swallow, and mentioned the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability earlier. They have done some great webinars that I think are available on YouTube. We'll hopefully find the links to them around things like assessing someone's swallow when they're in a disorder of consciousness. And they have also done another great webinar on using a device called the BioZoon, which some of you might have heard of, which is an excellent tool for even if someone can't necessarily swallow oral intake, it gives them tasters of fluids, and I've had a couple of patients who've used that, and it's added to their kind of quality of life to be able to get a taste of something. So there's other resources out there to link into, but I know we wanted to touch a bit more on hypersensitivity, didn't we, Jan? Mm-hmm.
And oral hygiene and oral care.
Yeah. Which I feel all of these things kind of link up, because if we can provide good oral hygiene and oral care, then that reduces the chance of the person being hypersensitive. So, which is, when I say that, I mean that you're trying to brush someone's teeth and they are distressed by it, they are refusing to open their mouth or turning their head away.
Maybe reflexively biting, yeah, things, biting toothbrushes and fingers.
Yeah. So prevention's better than cure, and we want to do what we can to allow that individual that if they get to a point weeks, months, a year plus down the line, that potentially there is the option to try and have something orally, that they are not so hypersensitive that we can't even begin to try that. And I'm thinking of a case that I did have where the individual had a tracheostomy in place for a long, long time, was minimally conscious but very drowsy a lot of the time, and was in bed a lot of the time, and a lot of factors that would make you think assessing that the swallow would not be in the best interest, because it could lead to lots of detrimental medical effects, you know, chest infections and things. But got to a point nearly 2 years, I think, post-injury. Tracheostomy was out, was up, sitting in a chair for long periods of the day, chest stable. So family were really keen, can we have another go? The downside being that this individual was very hypersensitive, and so even for staff to carry out oral care wasn't brilliantly tolerated. So we engage in a whole programme of working on tone management, on soft touch, of trying to improve kind of ability to even get the mouth open and have something in without without that reflexive biting if possible, without turning away. And this is where to mention something called facial oral tract therapy, that can be really, that some people might be trained in and aware of, and can be a nice way of supporting someone's oral movement, supporting their swallow, and can be really collaborative with, for example, physiotherapy, because a lot is about tone management and having a person sitting in the best position for them, because it's where all the muscles are connected, and if the person's not maybe sitting in the best way, that might have an impact on their facial muscles and on their ability to take things. So this is where we need to collaborate with our colleagues as well. And the other thing to mention around oral care is we want to encourage oral care for all of our patients. Yes. You know, that should be the end of that sentence. But I'm aware that with this group of people, we are talking about a group of people who have had something very significant to happen to them, that in those first few days and weeks, we might not even be sure that they are going to survive this event. And so maybe that means that oral care hasn't been high in the list of things to make sure that we get done, or it's not been possible for whatever reason, you know, other injuries and things like that. So it's just to put a caveat in there that I appreciate it's not always the easiest thing to do, or we think it's not something that we will need to kind of cross that bridge, but it's just to say, like,
early intervention.
Yeah, if there's a remote possibility that that person might be able to get to a point where we can have them engaging in some way, whether it's oral intake, but even just for simply looking after their mouth, mm-hmm. and reducing chances of infection, and for quality of life of
dignity.
Yep. Yeah, then it's important. I think that was
great.
Exactly what I was going to say about
and
that. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about specific assessments, because I know you've had some training for PDOC.
Yes. So this is where I'll reference back to those, to the guidelines set out by the Royal College of Physicians, the Prolonged Disorders of Consciousness Following Sudden Onset Brain Injury National Clinical Guidelines, which are also available online, for some easy reading.
I'll
of 200 pages.
Yes.
So they recommend assessment shouldn't be done in one definitive way. There are three assessments that they particularly highlight, and we are also encouraged to not just rely on one assessment
tool.
And it is an assessment tool. I think that's a good thing to highlight. It's about looking at behaviours, recognising them, looking for patterns. It's not about looking at a scan and deciding that person's in a vegetative state. So the three assessments that are commonly used and recommended is the SMART assessment, which stands for Sensory Modality Assessment and Rehabilitation Technique. That is one that you go in specific training to be able to do and to be certified to do. And I'll not talk too much about it because we don't want to...
It is certified.
But it's just to say that that is one that covers looking at all the senses, so taste, smell, touch,
vision,
and hearing, and you're doing that in a very prescribed way over a certain number of sessions. The good thing, particularly about SMART, there's lots of good things about SMART, but it is one of the few assessments that actively seeks information from family members.
And it's MDT, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's one of those, it's an assessment that anyone can be trained in. You know, it's not ring fenced to just occupational therapy can be trained in or anything like that. It is, anyone can be trained in it. So when I did the training, there was physios, speech therapists, neuropsychologists, etc. And we want to, we ask for family members, for staff that are familiar with that patient, you know, for them to provide information. So that's one assessment. I will kind of, we'll do a quick overview of these. One that we have just started using in our service, so I'm learning about it, is one called the JFK CRS, which JFK is nothing to do with the president, it's just to do with the name of the hospital it's developed in, and CRS is Coma Recovery Scale. So again, it's a series of like observations you would, that the clinician would be making, and making kind of clinical judgments about where that person is on that continuum.
And they're repeated, aren't they?
Yeah. So things like the SMART are prescribed that you would do 10 sessions, with things like the Coma Recovery Scale, and the other one we'll talk about, the WIM. Really, they're saying, you know, there's not a minimum, there's not a maximum to it. Obviously, there would have to be a judgment made at some point about, okay, we're not going to continue doing this particular assessment. You know, I think we have enough information. But yes, it's not a one-time assessment with any of these things. And yeah, the WIM that I mentioned there, the Wessex Head Injury Matrix. So that, if I remember right, is a series of 50 observations that, again, anyone can do within the MDT, or do within collaboration. I've certainly done it in the past where I've maybe been the one trying to elicit a behaviour, but physio have also been there, and then you can say, do we think that, you know, we just saw that, you know, because that can sometimes be the thing with prolonged disorders of consciousness. You can be thinking, do we think that what I just did caused that behaviour to happen, or were they about to do that anyway, you know? And this is the other reason why you want to repeat things, because you want to look for that consistency. The caveat I think a lot of us have around the WIM is that it's not sitting in a hierarchy of observations. So, for example, it says, I think it's, if you don't see 5 behaviours in a row, you discontinue at that point. But I think some people might look at it and think, oh, well, actually, the behaviour that you're trying to get at point 30, that person might be able to do that, but they've not done what was in point 12 to, yeah. So I think my understanding is maybe that the people that developed the WIM were maybe looking at these things, and I haven't seen a newer version of it. Maybe there is one out there. So if you're aware of it, then do let us know.
And you don't need training for the CER?
The CRS, no. The it's WIM. No. So the WIM is something you have to purchase. Can't remember the cost or anything. But the CRS is available online and has guidelines with it about what you're looking for.
Is that something we can put a link to?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
We'll do our best.
Yeah, there could be lots of links from this one. obviously, the other thing that I, of course, will argue as a speech therapist is with any of these assessments, we want to be considering, like I mentioned before, is there an aphasia that's impacting? Are there motor speech difficulties that's having an impact on participating in assessment? So I think we as SLTs have definitely got a really strong role in looking at this, because we are the ones that can say, I think actually when I adapted this question into a different format or broke it down, the person was able to answer, you know, and could do that consistently, which is suggesting that there's more of an element of aphasia rather than necessarily
a lack of awareness or alertness.
And we also have to think within disorders of consciousness, there's so many things that might be factoring in. Like I said, we're talking about people with very severe injuries to even be, that for us to even be considering that there's a disorder of consciousness there. There's going to be the brain injury fatigue that we are all well versed in and know about. There's the effect of the underlying medical condition that person has, any other injuries that person might have experienced at the same time that they acquired their brain injury, effects of medications, because some medications
motivation,
cause drowsiness,
initiation,
yeah,
all of those things.
Just all of these things, And I will say, as someone who is still not hugely experienced in this particular caseload, but I would reflect and see that my kind of level of skill and experience, the more that I have seen these patients, I've grown more confident. So there is something around that to be said as well. So I may be slightly contradicting myself when I'm saying earlier around, if you're the person that sees this and you've never seen a person like this before, you still have a certain skill set. That's not to take away from the fact that you might not be feeling at your most confident, you know, and that is okay. But I think this is a caseload of people where actually you can collaborate with your other disciplines really nicely. And mm-hmm.
And so could we talk a little bit about treatment? I was just thinking when you were talking about the physio and positioning, I could see how a physio would go in and do passive stretches and then I was thinking, okay, well, speech and language therapy, we probably take almost like a dynamic assessment approach where we're trying to stimulate certain behaviours repeatedly. Yeah,
I think this is where whatever assessment has happened in terms of getting a diagnosis of a disorder of consciousness can be a really good starting point. Because if you know, for example, the SMART assessment produces at the end a very robust report around what behaviours were seen in different areas. So if, for example, that person, the individual was seen to respond to auditory single stage commands on 7 of the 10 total sessions, and could do that for 3 out of 5 commands that they were asked per session. Well, there's a reasonable starting point for a speech therapist to think, okay, well, they can do it some of the time. Let's see if we can build on that with a core set of single stage commands. And that, I think, is something that any speech therapist would do, whatever your caseload was. You know, if you were seeing someone who'd had a stroke and you'd done an assessment on them.
You're looking at your baseline and then building on a strength.
Yeah, exactly. You're looking for your way in, aren't you? So that's your component, and hopefully the assessment has kind of gone, yeah, well, let's look at that in the context of certain times of day that they were more responsive. Are they making any changes to medication, to nutrition plans? You know, a lot of these patients are probably going to be NG or maybe PEG fed. So is that optimised? Are there points in the day where you know that they are up in their chair between certain hours that might work really well for seeing them, or actually that is exhausting for them? So then you wait until the afternoon when they have had a rest in bed for an hour before you go and do your session. So it's about figuring out where could you fit into that overall plan, and also figuring out what might be the priorities. You know, like, we of course think communication is the priority. But maybe for a short period of time, we need to take a back seat. Well, actually, the medications are reviewed and then we come back in, you know, a week later or something like that. So it's about figuring out where can we fit in? Where's the priorities for that individual? Look at what the strengths are and can we build on that like we would for anyone? But consider, you know, okay, so maybe they're showing that they are comprehending single stage commands, but is it a case of exploring how can they convey their responses to that in a different way? And that's where we're thinking about our alternative and augmentative communication. So for example, pressing a switch, can they do that? Can that be hooked up to some sort of device that allows them to make a selection? And whether that's a yes or no response, or can they make a selection to, you know, something to do with, for example, personal care, or whether they want to be in the bed or in the chair, you know, something that's very concrete is always a good starting point, as I'm sure we all know.
But something quite motivating as well, maybe a switch to turn the radio on and off, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're looking for quite kind of, yeah, quite concrete, quite kind of discernible things. Yes, this has happened or it has not happened.
A bit of cause and effect, sort of.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But obviously then there's other things to consider. We're back to our positioning. So this has been something...
Access, yeah.
Yeah, this has been something that I know I've found has been a challenge, that maybe the person can... do something, you know, you can have a setup of a switch when they're in their chair, but then actually they're exhausted after being in the chair for 4 hours, so they're back in bed. So can they still access the switch then? And what's that switch connected to? Where does that sit so that they can see it, so mm-hmm. that they're getting that motivation, like you say, and understanding context of what yeah. they're doing? So yeah, positioning, what's their vision like? Can they see what they are responding to, what's their language skills like, what's their motor skills, not just from speech, but physically hand be skills, able to yeah. to reach something. Is it their hand? Visual is special, it a head yeah. switch? Is it foot? Is it knee? Do you know? And then thinking about, well, where's all that? And that's where you're collaborating with your occupational therapy colleagues. Are they fatigued? It's all well and good, as I'm sure we all know. Someone might be able to respond to something and use a switch within your short 10-minute session, because that's maybe all that they can tolerate. But that isn't translating to...
Not going to generalise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and also the other thing I was thinking about with this is, fair to say, we've all got a speech therapist, all have different degrees of experience and skill level and comfort with AAC and mm-hmm. access to different devices. So that can be a barrier to being able to find the right thing for the right individual. So, you know,
trying to get some support there as yeah, well from yeah. various services in the community.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm lucky here in Lanarkshire that we have a speech therapist who's a specialist in AAC and has a wealth of knowledge around different types of devices and things, and that is her job role. So
maybe she'll come and talk to us about it, because I certainly would like some help with that.
And then I know things like, in the west of Scotland, we've got SETCI based at the Queen Elizabeth. I think through in Lothian, there's Call Scotland, and I imagine different areas
yeah.
have got access to different kind of AAC specialists and things. But I suspect there's variability in provision of that and how easy you can get hold of something. Yeah. So
I'm very conscious of our time, yes. Helen, and I know there was something really important that ChatGPT said we should just quickly talk about. Families. I know you've already mentioned families, and
yeah.
they're part of the MDT. So, you know, let's maybe talk about
yeah.
how we communicate with families, setting expectations.
Yeah, and I think it can be a really challenging thing to manage, because, and not just for speech therapists, but for anyone in that situation in the MDT, because we're dealing with something very sudden and very traumatic that has happened. There's no definite outcome here. In my experience, we're often dealing with younger individuals, and so you've got parents who are dealing with a child who's very, very unwell, and that's, you know, a whole host of difficult emotions and you know, the psychological impact of that must be massive.
And I think I remember from one of our very early talks from Lynn Grayson's research, where she looked at families' perception of the information they were provided, and at that point in time, we're talking first month and mm. things, you know, how much families are able to take on board and
yeah.
how much information they feel they're getting, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the thing that we just know about anyone in a stressful situation of any kind. Our ability to take in and retain information is not as good as when we are relaxed and ready for that information. That is just something that happens with our kind of our cognitive systems. add in the trauma, the emotions, the lack of sleep, the worries, all this. So I think for us as speech therapists, like I mentioned before, we've got the SMART assessment that does have as part of that, including families within the, you know, looking at observations and getting information from them, which I think is really helpful.
Yeah.
Gives them a role.
Yeah.
It shows that what they have got to add is valued and that they are being heard, because I think sometimes that has been some feedback that I've heard or other colleagues have heard, or, you know, when you maybe hear people speak about at conferences and things like that, you know, I feel like people weren't listening to me when I said this. Things I should mention, actually, another reference we could put in is there's a website, Health Talk, that has lots of videos from family members speaking about their experience of having a loved one in a prolonged disorder of consciousness and how that felt for them. But I think for us, include them, offer information when they ask for it, verbally written information people want to, you know, they might not want it there and then, but they can take it away. Include your family member in some sessions if you can, you know, and show them this is what the switch that I'm using, or these are the sorts of questions I'm asking. And if you are maybe, for example, trying to get a more consistent response to single stage commands, include them in that. Maybe they can do some of that in sessions as well.
And I think just some of the stuff that's come from acute hospitals to our services that the speech and language therapists have done is like life story books that, you know, that, I mean, we're trying to support somebody in a minimally conscious state, engage and be aware and alert. So, you know, having family photos that staff can then talk about, you know, with the person, whether they're awake or correct me if I'm using wrong terminology.
Well, if they're aware of I think the families always assume that they can hear you and can understand what you are saying, I think is a good starting point. But I mean,
so when you're doing personal care, you can be talking about something that's meaningful for that person, you know. So
something else actually to mention, again, another resource with the Neural Hostel for Neurodisability, is they have a PDoc toolkit that we have and our team have taken some elements from it, and it does include things that I think they called a chat mat, and it's other services. Well, you know, you hear things about the getting to know me document, for example, I know some hospitals use, but just about who am I as a person, what do I like, what do I not like, what are things to talk about, what do you definitely not talk to me about, these sorts of things. So knowing that, so getting family to talk about their child or their husband or whoever, encourage them, give them a wee bit of structure potentially for their visits, because they might feel that they're not getting anything back from their loved one, and that's a very different visit to if you go in to visit someone else in hospital who can maybe have a conversation with you. Instead, you're maybe going in and you're playing clips of TV shows that they, you know, they love, and you're chatting about it, or like you mentioned, Jan, about photos, you know, from holidays, oh, remember this, I remember when you did such and such. So it can be quite nice for families to then feel, okay, I've got something to kind of hang my hat on around what I do when I go to see that person, and just do nice things. I know other family members go in and maybe do paint nails, hand massage, a wee face mask, all these sorts of things, you know. Nice quality time. I'm aware there's probably lots more that we could talk about. I will just kind of mention, just to kind of sum up though, because sometimes people wonder a bit around, well, what happens at the end of rehabilitation? You know, when that kind of acute period of, you know, well, they're not really getting regular physiotherapy or speech therapy anymore. How do I know that maybe something might have changed? Or do I come back, get my family member referred back for review? So the RCP guidelines that I mentioned earlier, they state that all patients in a prolonged disorder of consciousness should have a review annually by a clinician of some sort. And this is where I think for speech therapists, we can give nice guidelines potentially to family or to carers around, okay, this is what we're seeing at the moment. If, you know, the if you we're not really seeing consistency in them responding to commands at one word level, if over time, you know, you're kind of a bit like, actually, every time I ask them to do this certain thing, they are doing it. And actually, I'm seeing that they're doing this other thing consistently when asked to it. There's just some very specific signs that you can maybe give that person, that family member, that care provider, something to look out for that maybe thinks, okay, there's a change there that's worth investigating a little bit more. But I would say it is quite helpful to be quite specific about what you're looking for. It's less around kind of going, oh, if you think that they're maybe doing something, it's actually really helpful that you kind of maybe almost diarise it, you know, you start to kind of take a note of, I asked them to open their eyes and 10 times they did it.
Yeah, consistent response over a period of time, like you did in the assessment.
Yeah, you're kind of almost doing a little mini kind of informal assessment, but it just... And
the family have spent that time with the team learning about PDOC, learning about what they've done. They're probably quite well informed about, you know, it's not just, oh, you know... he opened his eyes today when I asked him to open his eyes, but he hasn't done it any other time.
Yeah. And it's also just back to remembering that families will always want to look... Yeah, and not to take that away, you know. Yeah. We want to...
Be encouraging, but be realistic.
Yeah, there's definitely a fine line, isn't there? And it's incredibly difficult. And so we've got no straightforward answers to how you manage that, but... If you have been listening to this and you disagree with anything that I've said, then yeah, we would love to hear other points of view, other experiences. If you yourself have someone in your family who is in a prolonged disorder of consciousness and would like to talk about that and feel able to, then we would really appreciate that. But yeah, any comments or questions, then we are always happy to hear them. I think now Spotify has the option to put a reply directly on there, which I've only noticed in the last few weeks. But also you can message us through Instagram at Brainy Speech Therapists or on, it's not called Twitter anymore, it's now called X. As much as I don't like you, I'm calling it X. Twitter is a much better name, I'm sure we all agree. But yes, we are at BrainySLT on there, so you can message us if you have any comments or questions. But yes, thanks for listening. That was a long, heavy chat.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of your week.